Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Jinping Wang, assistant professor in the Department of History at the National University of Singapore, about her book, In the Wake of the Mongols, The Making of a New Social Order in North China, 1200 to 1600, which was published in 2018 by Harvard University Asia Center. Wherever you look, it seems, China is presented as a monolithic and geographical and historical entity. This impression is created, we might suggest, by a kind of conspiracy of outsider generalizations and the efforts of a Beijing government, which is keen to project visions of a single Chinese political body moving forward through history. But of course, centuries of human activity unfolding across a huge chunk of East Asian territory have produced a near endless series of contingent, local, contested, and multiplicitous events. The most obvious macro-level evidence of this insuppressible diversity are the long periods during which China was under non-Han Chinese rule, including during the Manchu Qing, Mongol Yuan, and Jurchen Jin dynasties between the 12th and the 20th centuries. Jinping Wang's new book begins at the conjuncture of two of these, the Jin and the Yuan, and continues forward to the Ming period, with the 13th to 14th century Mongol Yuan as the sort of main focus. She shows us as we go the complex ways that local people responded to the Mongol invasion of northern China, which began in the late 13th century, focusing on political, social, and religious life in Shanxi province, and introducing a cast of characters from wandering nuns to dispossessed literati, canal managers, and warlords' wives. Wang conveys an amazing level of local detail for a period so far back in time. Through insights derived from not previously studied stone inscriptions, we see how a whole range of people sought to reorganize their lives amidst a period of invasion and political upheaval, which, as she also shows, had a long afterlife. Throughout, deep local insights allow Wang to bridge the gap between this long-ago world and the present. Sketches, diagrams, and contemporary photos of many of the places discussed really bring the era to life. Temples and stone tablets, which are still standing today from the period, also reveal a level of historical continuity, which, if not quite allowing us to talk about the China that is portrayed in such broad brush terms as I mentioned earlier, certainly makes studying the country's long history a compelling activity in the present. But in any case, listeners, thank you very much in the present for listening. As I say, Jinping Wang, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Ed. Thanks for having me here. It's really an honor to be on the podcast.
Well, it's great to have you on, and I really enjoyed reading the book, and I hope, I'm sure listeners will enjoy listening to it, listening to the podcast. So if you could start us off perhaps by telling us a bit about where you studied, how you got interested in your specialisms, and what your kind of background in that area is.
Sure. My educational background, started from my college years in Peking University. I studied Chinese history in Beida, and then MA program. And from 2004 to 2011, I pursued my PhD program at Yale University, starting with Professor Valerie Hansen. And on the question of how I got interested in the field, well, I think, first of all, like many people in academia, we got into the field often because of some great and charismatic teachers we met. And it's definitely the same for me. And what's interesting that is that before my college, history was actually one of my most disliked discipline in high school. And partly because of history education back then was very much rigid and formulaic. And just the whole point about learning history is for national entrance exams. And the only way we need to learn history is through memorizing the details. And plus the content of history books is quite boring. So I never imagined myself would someday become a historian. But when I was in college, it happened that I got a chance to audit lectures on Imperial China by my former advisor, Professor Deng Xiaonan. And I always remember vividly that spring in 1998, when I was sitting in her class, her eye-opening lectures with a very clear and inspiring interpretation of Imperial China got me hooked into that history immediately. And so, not surprisingly, I wanted to become her student. And after enrolling in the MA program as a Providence student, the closer interaction with her also allowed me to see the fascination of the scholarly, the career. So maybe a part of being young and naive, and I thought that was the dream life I wanted. So,
what was it about Professor Deng's style or presentation of Imperial Chinese history that really grabbed you in that way?
Well, it's very different from what we had been familiar with, the Marxist interpretation of the Chinese history. And what struck me most was how she explained the change of the state institutions from the Tang and the Song, which, by the way, I always found the most boring part of Chinese history, but in such a new way that they're helping to understand a lot of things, why it was the case. For example, why traditionally people perceived the Song as the weak dynasty, while in Providence lectures, we saw Song dynasty in a very different view, which, it's a time with a very high level of civilization. So anyway, that was the one reason I decided to embark on a scholarly career. Of course, back then, I have no idea how stressful this life actually could be. And another reason for me to be interested in history has something to do with my early life experience. Grew up in China. And as I said, before college, of course, that wasn't the time like today we have in unlimited access of information through internet. The only I learned about the outside world through the television, through the books I could have access to. But still, I think I had a very naive view about the world, about our own country. And you all laughed at me. I really believed in what I was taught by the book, a textbook. So when I first went to Beijing to study in Peking University, and that really started to open a new window for me. And it's a kind of common experience for me and many other people in my generation in late 1990s. The new information we had, of course, the new understanding of the world we learned through the courses or the books that really made a very important impact on us. Put in a simple way, I always remember one of my college friends once said that we kind of experienced a vomiting of old knowledge that turned out to be fake, and we had to strive for new ways to fit in with new knowledge. And I decided that I don't want to be imposed on any that kind of information of knowledge, and if I want to remain truthful or critical about the world, scholarly, the career with lifelong learning seems to be the most proper way. And history certainly is one of the best disciplines, as the cliche says, to understand the present, we want to understand the past. So that's basically my intellectual and personal background of coming into interest in Chinese history.
Got it. And then how did that kind of carry you forward to pursuing postgraduate study and ultimately working on this particular period and Shanxi and so on?
Right. It's also, I had the professor Deng Xiaonan's approach to history had a very important impact on me in my early academic career. And when I was her student, well, she expertise in Song Dynasty history, particularly political and institutional history. And I guess at some point, again, was young and still naive, I didn't really like to study the political and institutional aspect of China. Maybe I was too young to appreciate the importance of understanding China. But I found myself more interested in a new emerging field of social history, which was clearly influenced by the Anglophone studies of Chinese history. So Professor Deng encouraged me to study social change in China that, in the Song history, there's a kind of watershed moment in 1127 when the north part of China was conquered by the Jurchen. So originally, then I was just suggested me to study how the Northern society changed or continued under the Jurchen rule. So that became my MA thesis topic. And when I decided to pursue the PhD program, then also told me that if you are serious considering working on the social history, then you have to go to the United States to study with those experts. So that basically became the reason for me to apply to a PhD program in the US.
And what's your impression? Has this situation changed much in the intervening years in terms of a focus on social history in China itself? I mean, is this a kind of direction that has gained more ground in the time since you started graduate school?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think now it's now no longer a new field. It's a field has been developed and flourished.
I see. Oh, well, that's great. So another you in the present might have remained in China. In any case, you studied in the US for your PhD, but not talking about the Song, talking about the Yuan was
that's
that,
right.
That was your focus in your graduate work. So how did the book come about? Was it something directly coming from your PhD?
Yes, the book derives from the PhD dissertation. And as I mentioned, my research started from the long-term social change in North China after 1127. But to my disappointment, that I found that the Chinese society under Jurchen rule did not change much as I had expected. So While I continued the research, during the graduate school, writing the dissertation, I was what struck me most is that it was actually not the Song Jing transition, but the Jing Yuan transition, and specifically the Mongol conquest, that triggered the structure change both in the society and the politics. So that basically guided me to shift my interest from the Song and the Jing and all the way to the Mongols. And plus, I was always fascinated by this period of the Mongol era. It was 20 years ago, it was the least studied field in Imperial Chinese history, I think.
Right, right. Oh, well, then you, you were a pioneer into this era, perhaps. So, perhaps we'll jump in to the sort of introduction and how you set the book up, specifically in relation to the Yuan Dynasty. Perhaps you could begin by talking to us about what was it that made the Mongol period, the Yuan period, distinct from other foreign dynasties, as you say. I mean, certainly anyone who studies contemporary or modern history in China may blithely assume that the Jin and the Mongols, the Jurchens and the Mongols, they both come from the north, and surely there are continuities there. But as you say, this was a radical transformation. So could you perhaps give us a general picture of what that transformation was under the Yuan?
Sure. Well, first of all, the Mongols differed from other foreign dynasties, such as the previous Jurchen Jin or the later the Manchu Jin. Due to unprecedented destruction they inflicted on the Chinese society, especially in North China during the conquest. So throughout the Chinese history, we knew that Chinese society experienced multiple devastating invasions by various foreign conquerors, yet none was as catastrophic as the Mongol conquest of North China in the early 13th centuries. As my book points out, that the two decades of conquerors and wars wiped out more than half of the population in North China, ruined much of the infrastructures and the farmland. So it basically dismantled the existing social order together. And this prolonged and traumatic nature of this conquest thus provoked massive depopulation and migration, which would in turn resulted in major changes in social structure. So one key change in this social structure occurred in the nature and identity of elites in Chinese society. That's how my book started from. And put in a simple way, the Chinese educated literati, who had dominated elite life in both the previous Northern Song and the Jing dynasties, were now replaced by previously marginalized social groups, especially the military strongmen and the religious leaders. And another key change in the social structure during and after the Mongol conquest was a whole new system of social stratification created by the Mongolian regime. So first of all, they classified its subject according to their ethnic and professional identity as defined by the Mongols. This, I think, many people who be familiar with Yuan history would know, that Mongols famously divided all people into four ethnic groups in the descending order of leaders. feathers, the Mongols on the top, of course, and then the Sumu people, who were the various categories of Central and Western Asian peoples as a second, and then the Han people, and who were mostly residents of previous Jin Dynasty, were ranked in third, and the Southerners, who were previous residents of the North Southern Song, were ranked at the bottom. So this ethnic four rank system was fundamentally a form of political stratification. It often came into play when the government handed out the office and other state honors. Meanwhile, along with the redefining ethnic identity, the Mongols also established a complex household system that organized the people into many hereditary household categories. And as a form of rigid social stratification, this household system yielded to a static society oriented to serve the needs of the Mongol imperial family and the Mongol state. So this is how the structure changed after the Mongol conquest.
Right, at
the social level. And at the political level, well, by the way, this is a major departure of my book from the dissertation that I incorporated in more discussion about how the Mongol conquest and rule introduced the new political order that provided the most immediate context for the image of social change that I described in the book. So politically, unlike other foreign dynasties like the Jurchen Jin and the later Manchu Qin that used the Chinese administrative models to rule Chinese population, the Mongols had a very distinctive way to do so. In addition to borrowing some Chinese dynastic institutions, they were much freer in borrowing from multiple historical models and from their own nomadic traditions, from Islamic and Central Asia regimes that they learned over the course of their conquest. So as a result, what we see is that the Mongols created a uniquely decentralized political order in China. And most interestingly is that first, they allowed multiple centers of legitimate political power held by all members of the royal family, including Mongol emperors, of course, and Mongol empresses and princes and their sons-in-law, and even the distinguished generals. So, put in a simple way, they reintroduced a certain system of aristocracy, which had already vanished in China after the 9th century.
Wow.
And then second, the Mongols also established various routes, both formal and informal, to these centers of power. And in their recruitment practice of bringing different Chinese people into their government, they did not prefer the civil service examinations. They actually suspended this defining Chinese institution for the majority of the dynastic time. And quite differently, they preferred the hereditary transmission, which was a strong tradition of the state politics, and they also preferred personal connections in recruiting officials. So along the way of suspending Chinese the examinations, the Mongol system of the politics successfully excluded most Chinese literati from the political power. And meanwhile, personal connections and job performance in state replaced literary skill and Confucian learning as the major qualifications for entrance to and promotion within the Mongolian officialdom.
Right, right.
So for many Chinese families and their men, what they face now in the Mongol era, to if they aimed to achieve upward social mobility by having access to the government office, which is always the route for Chinese families throughout its history, the most effective way for them to do so was to gain and secure the personal connections to the Mongol imperial families or other powerful patrons.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, we'll move on in a second, I think, to some of the experiences of those literati family that you mentioned.
Right.
I guess just one general question that pops up in relation to the broad changes that you've described when it comes to, in particular, this kind of ethnicized social hierarchy, the four different groups, as you mentioned, and also the radical transformation of political structure and hierarchies within that. Again, this question comes from a sort of pretty ignorant standpoint, much closer to the present. But given discussions and the relatively long-standing existence of a new Qing history and a new interpretation of the more recent foreign, I guess, dynasty in China, are there conversations around a new Yuan history? Are there controversies over the differentness of this period in Chinese history? And is that something that is in the field of Yuan studies?
Well, first of all, I've never heard anyone in the field to mention the new Yuan history or the new Qing history in parallel to the new Qing history. But if we consider the two salient features of the new Qing history study, namely seeing the Qing as a Eurasian empire, and paying much attention to non-Chinese sources, I think it's safe to say that there are indeed parallel scholarly trends in the Yuan studies. And while it is common knowledge that non-Chinese sources, especially the Persian Arabic sources, are equally crucial to studying the Mongol history.
Mm.
But for quite a long time, the studies of the Mongol Empire or the studies of the Mongol Yuan China, they belong to two separate fields. The formal, more or less, belong to a study of the Inner Asia the field, and the later, more or less, in the Chinese history. So also, this is partly due to the difficulty of studying the Mongol Empire, the linguistic difficulty. If you want to bridge that gap, you have to master, first of all, the two most important primary sources in language of Chinese and Persian, and then you want to include more sources in language of Arabic and Russian and even medieval European languages.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a reality, but indeed in the field we see that in recent decades there are scholarly efforts to deliberately bridging that gap precisely through using the multi-linguistic sources. So the studies by the Japanese scholar Sima Masaki or the American scholars Christopher Edward, it's clearly show this direction.
Mm,
and yeah, so, but I don't think this is a kind of inference from the new Qing history. I think it has, as a field, as inherent direction that as long as scholars could bridge the gaps of the sources, and plus with a broader Eurasia perspective rather than the Chinese perspective alone, would be the natural direction of the field.
That's very interesting. And also, as an aside as well, on your sources, in your particular study, perhaps you could just briefly say what you were drawing on in order to zoom into this level of local detail that you present in the book, and then we'll actually get on to talking about what that local detail was.
Right. Well, the major source base my book has drawn from are the local materials, particularly the steles and the stele inscriptions. Those are the materials the different local communities, different local individuals and families, they installed in different localities, sometimes within temples, sometimes at the graveyard. And of course, before my book, it's not new knowledge that inscriptions are important source base for our study of local history. Actually, I was inspired by my Yale professor, advisor, Very Hansen's first book, The Changing God in Medieval China, which used a lot of inscription to study the popular religion in southern China. But my use of those steles and inscription was a bit different from the generation before mine. It was mainly because I drew a lot of new information of these materials from fieldwork. Mm-hmm. So the first time I went to the place I studied, namely Shanxi, to collect these materials was in 2003 when I was writing my MA thesis. And before the fieldwork, I kind of assumed that a lot of materials we already have in the transmitted text, like the local gazetteers or the collection of the inscriptions that had become a popular practice among the Qing scholars after the 19th century, or the collection of literati and sources. But to my great surprise, from my first fieldwork, I realized the importance of approaching the steles and inscriptions from a different ways. That being said, that the being in the field allowed me to see the discrepancy between the inscription on the stone and the description in transmitted text. And the second allow me to see the existence of a rich body of unpublished materials. Mm-hmm. So from 2003, that's my first time fieldwork in Shanxi, and all the way to 2014 when I conducted the last fieldwork for the book project, I collected hundreds of those local materials, and that allowed me to portray a vivid picture of the local society that had experienced the centuries-long transformation from the Jurchen all the way to the Middle Ming period.
Great. Yeah, and I'd fully agree that the vividness and the real kind of this sense of intimacy, really, with people's lives and what's going on in that part of the world at the time is a real strength of the book, and you convey it beautifully. We'll move in then to the first of the sort of the first main chapter, where you discuss some of the changes that occurred after the invasion. You focus on Yuan Haowen, a particular literati figure who, right. I guess, very conveniently had a career or a life which spanned or overlapped with precisely the period when the Mongols turned up on the northern fringes. So could you tell us something about Yuan Haowen and his life and how his story reveals what it reveals to us about the status and the fate of Han literati under Jin, and then as the Mongols, as the Yuan began?
Sure. Well, Yuan Haowen was one of the most famous the Chinese literati in the late Jin period. And he produced I used him as the major influence for my first chapter, and traced his his life experience as a window to demonstrate the society before the Mongol conquest and after was partly because he was the most productive writers of the late Jin, and he left the richest body of materials about the late Jin society and early Mongol period, including his anthologies and his collected biography of Jin literati and anecdotes. And also, he himself was a fascinating figure, being a talented scholar, good at poetry. I loved his poetry a lot. When I was writing the chapter, I remember that I often, like a ritual, often started to read his poetry for 20 minutes or around, and then kind of immerse a little bit to thinking about his experience, and then started to write. So his life experience, which had my first chapter divided in the three major parts, nicely parallel to the Jin society that had witnessed a flourishing of examination-based society, which continued in the Northern Song. After the 1211, when the Mongols first attacked the Jin, Yuan Hao-wen's experience paralleled the experience of many Northern literati who were struggling with being dislocated to the new capital of the Jin, and making a living because the majority of their family had lost their property and connections back home, back hometowns, and while still trying to pass civil service examinations. Yeah. And then his last period of his life from 1234 to 1257, about a little more than two decades, that was at the end of the Jin rule, and then early period among the Mongol rule. His experience showed vividly how, first of all, many Northern former Jin, the literati, lost all their political and social elite status. Now many of them, they had to rely on emerging new elites for survival. So for Yuan Hao-wen himself, he relied on a group of warlords and others, and many are his friends, and even his own daughter, who embarked a very different path of life, being transgenderized, monks or nuns, in order to survive the chaos. Mm. So his whole life experience was a kind of micro history of not just for literati, but the whole Northern, the whole Jin society and its civil culture experienced those stages of flourishing, decline, and demise. Right. In the conjuncture of the Mongol conquest.
Yeah, it really captures that, his life story. And I think your the poetry ritual that you describe of immersing yourself before getting down to writing really works, because personally I felt like I was really following this guy along, and there's something slightly tragic about, or tragicomic maybe, about he repeatedly fails the exams, and then he finally passes, right, seemingly at the worst possible time, when suddenly, right, it's not actually any use anymore. And so, yeah, there's a real richness with which I think his life story evokes the struggles that people in his position were going through.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
But you mentioned these alternative strategies for seeking social advancement that people adopted, including allying with warlords and then also becoming more involved with religious orders. So your second and third chapters focus respectively on the Chenjun Daoists that you just mentioned and the Buddhists, Buddhist order. So could you sort of describe for us, please, how the religious landscape changed under the Mongols, how it was that each of these respective religious traditions was able to attain a new role and how people interacted with them as the Mongols took charge?
Sure. Well, first of all, the emerging new religious order, particularly the Chenjun Daoist and the Buddhist, occurred in a broader political context, as I mentioned earlier. But one specific aspect I probably didn't highlight in the earlier introduction about this transformative political order that the Mongols brought into China was the Mongols preferred recruiting the people based on their personal connections and the job performance. So among those different occupations, the Mongols uniquely preferred the four social groups that, judging from the traditional Chinese standards of the Northern Song or even under Jurting, would be a kind of marginalized group. They include those military men, they include the specialist household, and the most interesting group was the religious leaders. So both Buddhist and the Daoist, they emerged as a powerful social elite, and in the Buddhist case later even as a political elite in this new political environment. And for the story of the Chenjun Daoist, what's most striking about this movement is that how fast it transformed from an originally local ascetic religious movement that attracted a few followers to a nationwide religious order that not only brought in people from all walks of life. As my chapter shows, there are two distinguished social groups that were accommodated in the Chenjun Daoist order during and after the Mongol conquest. First was the former Jing literati, and the second was the Northern women from all kinds of the social background, including the previous Zhou Qing noble women, the previous women from the elite families or village ordinary families. And so the reason why the Chenjun Daoist was successful in appealing to the Northerners in the early 13th century, my chapters explains from the doctrinal, social and political aspects. And in putting a simple way, doctrinally, the transcendentalism, especially under the leadership of Qiu Chuji, who was one met Genghis Khan and gained the Mongols' patronage, they were inherently concerned about the public welfare. And so they made a strategic shift of their religious development from the previously ascetic practice to the salvational goal of saving the people in troubles. Mm-hmm. And what they did was to use the privilege they got from the Mongols, especially the Genghis Khan, and turn them into their own institutional strengths. So, for example, unlike the previous, the Northern Song or the Jurchenjin state, the early Mongol rulers, I would argue they probably didn't know much about the religious landscape in China before. They kind of generously granted a lot of privilege to the transcendentalists that had been reserved for the states. Mm. For example, the autonomy of issuing the ordination certificates, the autonomy of issuing the monastic plaques, which were the most effective strategies the Chinese states, imperial states, often used to control the religious population and religious communities. Mm. And in this early in the early Mongol periods, the Chenjin leaders capitalized on these newly gained privileges. For example, they distributed those ordination certificates among the Northern refugees, especially the prison of war. And because according to Genghis Khan's edict, one could gain the freedom as he only needed to be Qiu Chuji's disciple to gain the freedom. So at the time, as I explained in the introduction, we have to always keep in mind that that was the time that when the society was experienced extremely pain and dislocation and destruction. And Chenjin in Taoism proved to be the most effective way to help people navigate those difficulties while providing new means of life to people. Mm. So, for example, the most surprising evidence came from how they provided the former Jin literati who joined the religious order new jobs in the Chenjin order and a new lifestyle in the Chenjin monasteries. Mm. Through creating a new transcendentalist education system and encouraging the formal Jin literati to write the Chenjin history, to compile the Chenjin materials. So many formal Jin literati became eminent Chenjin masters as lecturers, as the leaders of monastic institutions, and some even became the Chenjin patriarch. Mm-hmm. And similarly, they also used their institutional strengths to provide the most vulnerable social group, namely the Northern women, especially from those help powerless, the peasant class, the new way to survive. Right. So as the chapter gives a few examples how women from different previous social groups, including the noble Jurchen women and the village women, the changing order gives them different ways to play public leadership roles in rebuilding the local communities.
Right.
And for powerless village women in particular, having a transgendered identity first guarantees their safety in this chaotic time. And second, they give them institutional support, both by human and material resources and by political connection that the whole transgender order had achieved. So these women were able to carve out a space for themselves, for their children, especially for women who had lost their husbands, lost their parents. And they allowed them to have a new way of life in the transgender convents. Meanwhile, these transgender convents were also functioned as the orphanage. So we found the examples, we see that many transgender nuns, they actively brought in the orphaned young girls into the transgender convents, and they also some of these transgender institutions even helped their monks and nuns to take care of their natal families' graveyards. Right. Because at the time, a large number of Chinese families were fragmented. And as a key concern for Chinese culture, this is a norm of filial piety, taking care of your ancestors, their dead spirits, their tombs was not a small matter.
Correct.
So in this chaotic time, the transgenderism as a religious institutions provided a very innovative ways for both the living and the dead to survive, and in a way even to thrive, as we see in some careers of these transgender monks and nuns. They were able to establish those the connections to high level the Mongol imperial families, the powerful patrons that they could use, turn these political connections into useful social resources when they expanded their institution throughout North China.
I see. And how did that compare? I mean, those are really terrific insights to have regarding the transformation, the relative centers of power, and who was taking care of people as well, I guess, at that time. Certainly, there are more recent examples of, I guess, powerful groups ravaging the population and then leaving it up to charity and religious organizations to take care of the social side.
Right.
But without going into that, how did the position of Buddhism compare to what you just described with regard to social organization and social support, and then also political power?
Well, on the social level, the Buddhism played an equally important role, but I would argue that in the early Mongol era or in the immediate decades after the Mongol conquest, it was mainly the transgenderites that played the leading roles of rebuilding local communities. But the Buddhism, while taking up similar roles in the social reconstruction, their distinctive place in the Yuan China was the unique strength they achieved in the political world. And this happened mainly after 1260, when Kublai Khan became the great Khan of the Mongol Empire. And due to his personal belief in Buddhism, especially Tibetan Buddhism, from the Kublai Khan's reign onward, the Buddhism replaced the Transcendentalism to become the leading religious organization. And now not just in North China, but in South China as well, after the Mongols conquered Southern Song in 1279. And the Buddhist also created a distinctive religious order nationwide, but in a very different ways from the Transcendentalist. So the Transcendentalist was very, very interesting that it created a centralized religious organization with the headquarters in Yanjing and today's Beijing, and having its as a national leader, Chen Zhen Patriarch, who would often be sanctioned and authorized by the Mongol state. And it has the three different layers of institutions. The top, as I mentioned, this headquarter, and the regional, the regional centers of often center surrounding the one major Transcendental institution, like the Palace of Eternal Joy I described in chapter 2, and then the different local level institution. So the Transcendentalist order is was built upon its own institutional structure, but the Buddhist order was a bit different, as that prior to 1260, when the Mongol state created a nationwide institution order for Buddhism, the Buddhist communities and Buddhist lineages in China, they did not have a similar centralized structure. They had nominal leaders, but their organization did not work as effectively as the Transcendentalist did. So that explained to some extent why it was the Transcendentalists who could use their highly organized institutions to play leading roles in the post-war community rebuilding. But the Buddhists, they benefited from the state patronage much more than the Taoism after 1260. So basically what happened was that this was the one aspect, as I mentioned in the introduction, about the new political orders the Mongols brought. Basically, the Mongols made the religious administration, especially the Buddhist administration, a separate and semi-autonomous bureaucracy, which was relatively independent from the civil bureaucracy, while enjoying the equally important significance and privilege. So that means that this new Buddhist order created by and within the Mongol regime opened a new way for Chinese men to achieve the political office through an unconventional way, namely through the religious ladder, especially the Buddhist bureaucracy.
Right.
So my chapter, the chapter 3, use a local case study on a Buddhist monk official named Zhang Zhiyi on Mount Wutai, and explored in detail how his monastic career benefited his natal family in the local Dingxiang County, and how their kingship institution closely overlapped with the monastic institution on Mount Wutai, giving men like Zhang Zhiyi and his younger brother and his two sons the distinct ways of having access to the government office, not just in Buddhist bureaucracy, but also other government agencies that related to Buddhism, and also help their native family to become a village elite to back their home village.
Right.
So
right.
It was a very very unique episode of Chinese both Chinese society and Chinese religion that we had not expected to see in that in the middle period of China.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I would encourage listeners to pick up the book and get into that because, yeah, as you say, it's a really fascinating and again, as in many areas of the book, a compellingly detailed look at an individual's life, which tells us a lot. We don't perhaps have time to go into detail either about the following chapter, 4, which discusses also a similarly kind of intimate and close quarters level of life, particularly in the irrigation associations and rural communities, and how some of these religious dynamics, as well as others, other power dynamics, played out on the ground. But again, I would say to listeners that they should buy the book and read that, because that's really where lots of the dynamics that we've been discussing in general terms play out in fascinating ways. But finally, Jinping, perhaps we'll move on to the last chapter, chapter 5, which discusses continuity and change and how these patterns that you're describing that got laid down during the Mongol period carried forward into the Ming. This is another area which is particularly fascinating just in terms of the longer term transformations that this period wrought. So what were the continuities and what were the changes that you wanted to highlight here?
Well, the continuity that I tried to highlight is the so-called the new social order that I have spent 3 chapters to describe from Transcendent Taoism to Buddhism to this the clergy's role in the irrigation society. I tried to demonstrate how this new social order continued in the particular locality of Shanxi, in some ways similar to the Mongol era. And on the change, I mainly focus on how this the Yuan-style social order gradually vanished in the Ming Shanxi, and how from the mid 16th century, a totally new different pattern of social change emerged.
So did that carry forward, I mean, in a wider area than Shanxi? What is your sense of the sort of residue there from the Mongol period into the Ming? I mean, when we're talking about whether, you know, new Yuan histories exist and so on, one of the hallmarks of the Qing too, or new Qing history, is looking at how Qing and Manchu patterns really carried forward into China's 20th century too. Is there evidence of these things, a prolongation of Mongol ways of doing things in a broader sense in Ming China?
Well, it wouldn't be the case for the whole Ming China, but my chapter argues that it would be the case for some regions, especially in North China, where had institution that is that was the Mongol legacy in the Ming, namely the princely institution, and their existence helped the organized religions, in other words, Buddhist and Taoist, to continue in a very different social political world of Ming, and this goes back to the point of the Mongol era. Of the new social order featured in the religious dominance, as I mentioned in the conclusion, that in the Mongol era, these either Transcendent Taoist and Buddhist, their powerful social presence benefited fundamentally from the 3 types of political resources they had access to. So first, the the Mongol imperial family's patriot, and which was manifested in the state, the pro-religious policy, like tax exemptions, mm-hmm. that played a big part for both religions to accumulate enough wealth and materials to able to play the roles as I described. And second is the religious bureaucracy they built for Buddhist and to a less degree for the Taoist too. And the second was those different centers of power, especially the members of imperial families. They also acted as the regional patrons for the religious clergy. Mm-hmm. So when it came into the Ming era, we see the rapid disappearance of such political conditions for the organized religions, mainly for the first two categories. The Zhuanzhang's, the Ming founders' religious policy was very much restrict the religious population or even persecute Buddhism and Taoism. So the clergy no longer enjoyed the legal and the political status they had in the Yuan. Mm. And the religious group, except for a few religious centers like on Mount Wutai, they still enjoyed imperial patronage, but the nationwide they lost the state support, including the tax exemption privileges. But on the third category, the patronage from those the separate powers of centers of power that mark a big difference among different regions.
Right.
So for regions like Shanxi, as I described in the chapter, and also in other northern Chinese regions like Shanxi, like Shandong, they all had the princely institutions installed by Zhuanzhang. And in the early Ming era, they enjoyed tremendous political, economic, and social power. Although after the Yongle era, when we know that Yongle Emperor usurped the throne by using his princely army and power, overall, the Ming tried to circumscribe the princely authority. But in those regions, the princely institution still played a role as the powerful patrons for the other social groups.
Right,
so
right.
As I chapter demonstrate, and they created a kind of patron-client relations with some religious group, but for their own interest, and that was different from the Mongol period's case. But nonetheless, we see this kind of continuity of the patron-client relationship between the religious organizations and those, in a way, we can call them aristocratic nobles.
Right, right, right.
Well, so only after that patron side, they themselves started to withdraw from the historical state, we saw this new order that emerged after the Mongol conquest came to a permanent end in the mid-Ming.
Right, right. And I think tracing that gradual sort of fade out, that kind of transition, is also a really important aspect of this book, from the Jin to the Yuan, and then from the Yuan to the Ming, helps us not to understand Chinese history as cut up into, Song, Jin, Yuan, Ming, Qing, but in this kind of sort of as though one period directly ends and the next one is a complete transformation. So that's fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Jinping. We've taken up a fair bit of your time. And thank you so much for explaining your work to us and really shedding light on an area which I think is a particularly fascinating part of Chinese history. Before we go, perhaps you could answer our traditional New Books Network final question, namely, what is it that you're working on currently?
Well, I'm currently working on two projects, and both of them actually continues my inquiry about the Yuanming transition that was only touched upon in my first book. Actually, the fifth chapter about the Ming was a major departure of my book from the dissertation. If you the book basically ended 200 more years of time span comparing to the dissertation, but it does get me think about how a new dynastic transition from the Yuan to the Ming and from the non-Chinese ruler to the Chinese ruler again could have triggered new ways of social and cultural change in North China. So the in line with this thought, the first project now I'm working on is an intellectual and cultural history of transgenderism in the Ming and period. Well, I really got interested in this religion, this religion when I was doing research for the first book. But my first book basically only look at this religion from a social historical perspective, and it only demonstrate the unprecedented level of social reach of this religion. But I was curious about how this transgenderism, which started as a local level ascetic religious group to a national level large Taoist school, which even continues till today, that's being one of the two major religious school. And I want to in my new project, I want to look at how some critical transgenderist ideas and practices seeped into cultural expressions in the Yuan and the Ming. So, for example, in the forms of the temple murals and the Northern drama text and some Ming novels like The Journey to the West. So basically, I try to understand how this religion's kind of tenaciously survived the early Ming persecution and continued to grow and become a major Taoist school in China, in late Imperial China.
Great. And how about
the other project? Yeah, my second project focuses a region of Datong, which is the most northern part of Shanxi, and it was deliberately excluded from my first book. And this is due to its own distinctive historical trajectory. And because unlike most other Shanxi regions and in general North China regions, the Datong region was a major part of the so-called 16 prefectures that were given to the Khitan in 936 during the Five Dynasty period. So these regions, they experienced more than 400 years of consistent non-Chinese rule under Khitans, Jurchen, and the Mongols until 1368 when the Ming overthrew the Yuan. So focusing on Datong and again drawing from the local materials through fieldwork, my new book project aims to delineate this trajectory of social change of this particular region from the 10th century all the way to the 17th century. And due to the distribution, the availability of the sources, the majority part of the book will focus on the Ming period, and partly because I want to explore how this region transformed from a consistent part of the inner Asia world instead of the Chinese, Han Chinese world, and then kind of hinterland of Mongol Empire to a new immediate borderland, a defense line of the Ming Empire against the Mongols.
Wow.
So I want to examine how this newly made Chinese frontier society worked, well, first under the interplay of the four key institutions of Ming China in the Northern Frontier Society, namely the military, the princely, the religious, and the mercantile. And then second, under the close interactions between the Han Chinese and the Mongols in the two sides of Great War, via war and trade. So, basically, I wanted to continue my inquiry that I started to think about when writing the fifth chapter of the first book about the new transformation of frontier society in the Ming. And with their close contact with the Mongols, because I always have this fascination about the Mongols and their importance in the Chinese history that I believe has been underestimated.
Sure. Well, I think you've demonstrated very well in this book that importance needs to be reckoned with, and I'm sure these other exciting sounding projects will similarly help to raise issues that, as you say, have been overlooked. I think they sound fantastic. In any case, thank you so much again, Jinping, for being on the show. It was great talking to you.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Great. And listeners, thank you too for listening to New Books in East Asian Studies, which is a podcast on the New Books Network. We will speak to you next time. Goodbye.